White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right here on a Saturn's Day, November the 29th, 2014, on a beautiful day here in Indiana. It's getting up into the 50s today. Sun's shining, no snow, well, a little bit of snow, it's melting off, and everything's fine. The day after the day that we should have been revering our parents and our ancestors and not spooks in the sky. Yeah, I'm going to put that sign up out on the front of the place out here, that big sign of mine, lit 24 hours a day, that says, hey, did you revere your mom and pop, or did you worship spooks in the sky? Yeah, that's what I'm going to put up out there. And we are at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, right here. And then go up to resist.com and get educated. Quit getting educated by the Jew tube. Go up there and get educated at resist.com. We've got everything you need to know to save your ass, I'll tell you that. Well, on Saturn's Day, usually we put a show on here by Sling Blade. Now, let me remind you, these shows were made some time ago. There's no dates on them. So, anyhow, there's things on here that may be dated or something that we found out different later on, and we disagree. So, anyhow, I'm going to play one, and this is, I believe, about the sugar. And if you want to really read about the sugar, you get that book, Sugar Blues, I'm telling you. Sling Blade may mention it, because a lot of people don't realize that great empires have fallen and collapsed very much due to the sugar intake of their armies and so forth. And remember, most of the slavery was based on sugar in the beginning, at least, and still was, you know, not just cotton. And so a lot of people forget about that. So anyhow, the more we can get sugar out of our diet, the better off we're going to be. Because right now, there's sugar in everything. You can't get away from some sugar. But boy, I'll tell you, you better limit it. I'm still trying to do it because I'm trying to outlive all my enemies, whoever they are. Okay, let's go. Let's see if we can find Sling Blade. Incidentally, Sling Blade's on one of his sabbatical. I haven't heard from him in a while, so I hope he's okay out there in the land of Lincoln, running around with all those negars over there.
We're going to talk about our disgusting habit of eating ground glass. That's right. All of you out there, including myself, even though I'm kicking the habit today, we have a bad habit of eating ground-up glass. This ground-up glass, when it goes through your veins and arteries, it just scrapes the shit out of the inside of your veins and arteries. It has an adverse effect on your bones and on your teeth. It makes you gain weight. It's just poison, and it's white. I'm talking about none other than sugar. Sugar consumption, when it's raised up, sugar consumption is the increasing level of sugar consumption throughout its history in the Western world is a direct link to the rise of mental illness and a bunch of other health problems. It's interesting to note that from the Muslim Empire, actually from the Sanskrit, we get the word kanda, K-H-A-N-D-A. That's where we get our word candy. Candy is poison. All right, but let's let's read some things here. And if you're bored with this, well, that means you don't want to change. You should always be willing to evolve. You can never rest on your laurels. Too many of us in the struggle. And I'm telling you right now, I've been to a lot of racial events, whether they be Hitler celebrations, Nordic fests, parties where barbecues were just racialists getting together. For a people who's supposed to stand for something, we are, you know, take this for what it's worth. It's just my observation, but we are some of the most out of shape people I have ever seen. But we're supposed to stand for a higher standard. How is that possible? I think that may be an example of what type of people the struggle is actually attracting. You know, maybe we're the type of people we're attracting are people who couldn't get friends in another part of society. The shoe fits, wear it. But it says here, an early European observer credits the widespread use of sugar by Arab desert fighters as the reason for their loss of cutting edge. Leonhard Rauf is the German botanist who gave his name to the plant Raufa serpentina. The derivatives of the plant are still in use today as sedatives and tranquilizers. All right, that's the plant that's named after him. Rauf made voyages in the lands of the Sultan through Libya and Tripoli. His journals, published in 1573, contain timeless military intelligence. Now here's a quote. It says, the Turks and Moors cut off one piece of sugar after another, and so chew and eat them openly everywhere in the street without shame. In this way, they accustom themselves to gluttony and are no longer the intrepid fighters they had formerly been. Now, the other day, there was I heard it all over, like, conservative radio, that there was the new guy that was appointed to NASA, a guy who has a pretty impeccable military record, said this Al Jazeera TV, and I guess it leaked all over the American TV, with the exception of swine pieces of shit like MSNBC and CNBC and CNN, but everyone else reported on it. This guy was given a charge by President Obama to make kids interested in math and engineering, get youngsters interested in space or something like that. But he said, and foremost, to reach out to the Muslim world and make them feel good about the contributions that they've made to math and science. This is our president. He gives this charge to the top guy of NASA to reach out to the Muslim world and make them feel good about their contributions to math and science. What are we in the fucking feel good business now? We got to make the whole world feel good about themselves, or the black, brown, and yellow world? I hope this guy eats a big cube of sugar and just fucking dies. But anyways, the Muslim advances in science and algebra and the creation of the zero and whatever, that was their accomplishments, you know. Don't forget also that the Muslims got a lot of their knowledge from the Greeks. They saved a lot of Greek writings and Greek geometry and stuff like that from being destroyed by the barbarians, the German barbarians. I mean, they were, you know, as smart as they were in the natural world, as far as being great woodsmen and hunters and stuff like that. You know, they didn't really have a record of written languages at this time. That's what I like about Might of the West. In that book, it talked about right around the 10th and 11th century, there was an explosion of knowledge all over Europe at multiple places at the same time. And it didn't come from an outside source. It was spontaneous. It was like it was some kind of cognitive explosion of knowledge in multiple places throughout Europe right around that time. But anyways, the Muslims, you know, in the early phase of their empire building, I guess, you know, when the Moors took Spain, I guess, and the 7th century and or the 8th century. And a good deal of those Moors were probably white. But also, they declined as a people because they... I believe there's two reasons why they declined as a people and why you haven't heard anything about them in the realm of science in the last 800 to 900 years. It is because... Well, maybe three things. Because of this dog-fuck religion that they got. This dumb-ass religion. Everything is the will of Allah. Nothing has natural laws anymore. You throw an apple up in the air, it comes down. That's the will of Allah. Get the fuck out of here. You have this stupid-ass religion. And you Muslims out there listening right now, when I say stupid-ass religion, I want you to picture Muhammad's face on the ass of a donkey. And you guys want to threaten people out there for insulting Muhammad? Come get me. Come get me. I've stated numerous times what town I live in on these shows. Come get me. You want to make threats to American people? You better not paint or draw Muhammad. Fuck you. Come get me. You know what town I live in. Won't be hard to find me. But they declined, I believe, as a people, one, because of the religion, two, because of the ingenious white Muslims mixed their blood with black and brown Muslims, and three, because of sugar. All right, let's continue on here. All right, Raoul viewed sugar addiction among the Sultan's armies in much the same way as modern observers discovering American forces in Asia hooked on heroin and marijuana. The Turks use themselves to gluttony and are no more so free and courageous to go against their enemies to fight as they had been in former ages. This may be the first recorded warning from the scientific community on the subject of sugar abuse and its observed consequences. The word scientist was not to be coined until 1840. The test tube and the laboratory were a good way off. But Raoul seems to have had insight into the view human beings as whole men in an environment with a history rather than a litany of labeled symptoms. After the rise of Islam, sugar became potent political stuff. Men would sell their very souls for it. The same fate that had crippled Arab conquerors was now to afflict their Christian adversaries. En route to wrest the holy places from the grip of the Sultan, the Crusaders soon acquired a taste for the sauce of the Sultans. I'm sorry, the sauce of the Saracens. I guess there's bad lighting in here. Some of them wanted only to languish in the land of the infidels until they could get their fill of fermented cane juice and sugar candy. European rulers discovered that their ambassadors at the Egyptian court were being corrupted by the sugar habit and won over by bribes of costly spices and sugar, some had to be withdrawn. The last major crusade ended in 1204. A few years later, the fourth Lateran Council assembled in Rome to plan crusades against heretics and Jews. Then in 1306, Pope Clement V, in exile at Avignon, received an appeal for a renewal of the crusades of the good old days. Copies of the appeal went to the kings of France and Italy and Sicily, France and England and Sicily. This early diplomatic position paper outlined a southern sugar strategy for bringing the wily Saracens to heel. It's quoted here by Clement V, says, "In the land of the Sultan, sugar grows in great quantities, and from it sultans drew large incomes and taxes. If the Christians could seize these lands, great injury could be inflicted on the Sultan, and at the same time, Christendom would be wholly supplied from Cyprus." Sugar is also grown in the Morea, Malta, and Sicily, and it would grow in other Christian lands if cultivated there. As regards Christendom, no longer would follow. Well, that was the beginning of it right there. We had hardy, virile men. I mean, could that be why the Vikings and the Saxons were such formidable warriors? It's because they had a diet that was free of sugar? Yeah, they had honey. Honey's different. Something to think about. Okay. All right, talking about the Portuguese here. No, I'm going to skip ahead. All right. 10 years later, the Pope was induced to extend his blessing to the slave traffic. Papal authority was extended to attack, subject, and reduce to slavery the Saracens, pagans, and other enemies of Christ. The ostensible rationale of Christianism abroad was the same one that justified hoarding the hounding of heretics and Jews at home to save their souls. In fact, that the sweat of black brows could tend the new fields of sugarcane in Madeira and the Canary Islands was a providential fringe benefit for the Portuguese Empire. For centuries, the scriptures were systematically perverted to provide solace for slave trading sugar, Christian sugar pushers. In his prophetic 1923 work, Cain, the black American poet, I don't give a fuck what he says, sugar and slavery were two sides of the coin of the Portuguese realm. By 1456, Portugal had control of the European sugar trade. However, Spain was not far behind. When the Moors were expelled from Spain, they left behind cane fields in Granada and Andalusia. On his second voyage to the New World in 1493, Christopher Columbus took along some hunks of sugar cane at the suggestion of Queen Isabel. In his book, composed during the voyage, Peter Martyr claims that the explorers found sugarcane growing in the islands of Hispaniola. Columbus suggested transporting West Indian natives to work in the Spanish sugarcane plantation. Queen Isabella was against it. Okay. Just giving you a history of sugar and how it played a role in Western culture. By this time, the Portuguese were growing sugarcane with slave labor in Brazil. One element of their sugar strategy was ingenious. While other European countries were burning Jews and heretics and witches, more about witches later, the Portuguese emptied their jails and condemned criminals and sent them to colonize their possessions in a new world. Convicts were encouraged to interbreed with heathen female slaves to produce a hybrid race that could survive in the tropical sugarcane fields. See? Promoting race mixing, they were essentially promoting race mixing in the interest of economics. All right, Dutch traders got into the act around 1500. Skillful seamanship made it possible for them to engage in cut-rate shipping. Slaves were sold on credit to make up for a late start. The Dutch soon established a sugar refinery at Antwerp. Raw sugarcane was shipped from Lisbon, Canary Islands, Brazil, Spain, and the Barbary Coast for processing in the Antwerp refineries. The sugar was then exported to the Baltic states, Germany, and England. By 1560, Charles V of Spain had built the magnificent palaces of Madrid and Toledo out of taxes on the sugar trade. No other product has so profoundly influenced the political history of the Western world as has sugar. It was the nickel under the foot of much of the early history of the New World. The Portuguese and Spanish empires rose swiftly in opulence and power. Opulence. Marble mouth. As the Arabs before them had crumbled, so they too fell rapidly into decline. Well, I believe sugar did play a role in the decline of Spain and Portugal. In the 14 and 1500s, they were world powers. But I think bringing in a lot of black slaves into Portugal and Spain was their downfall also. To what extent that decline was biological, occasioned by sugar binging at the royal level, we can only guess. However, the British Empire stood by waiting to pick up the pieces. In the beginning, Queen Elizabeth I shrank from institutionalized slavery. Okay. All right, let's see what they have to say about this. We're talking about, I mean, the sugar was responsible for the making of rum, you know. They started putting more and more sugar in rum and stuff like that. All right, sugar pushing had become so profitable by 1660 that the British were ready to go to war to maintain their control. The Navigation Acts of 1660, as their object, the prevention of transport of sugar, tobacco, or any other product to the American colonies to any port outside of England, Ireland, and the British possessions. Okay, so you couldn't ship that stuff nowhere. All right, although some American historians like to argue that it was the British tax on tea that precipitated the War of Independence, others point to the Molasses Act of 1733. Well, 1733 is four decades away from independence, so I don't know. Maybe. Which levied a heavy tax on sugar and molasses coming from anywhere except the British Sugar Islands in the Caribbean. The ship owners of New England had cut themselves in on the lucrative trade of slaves, molasses, and rum. They sailed off with a cargo of rum to the slave coast of Africa to exchange it for blacks. Okay. So other blacks played a big role in the enslavement of other blacks. Well documented, whom they hauled back to the West Indies for sale to the eager British plantation owners. There they took on a load of molasses, which they hauled back to be distilled into rum and then peddled to their heavy drinking local customers. Long before the Boston Tea Party, the annual consumption of rum in the American colonies was estimated to be 4 gallons for every man, woman, and child. All right, that was the annual consumption. The Molasses Act of 1733 posed a serious threat not only to the American colonial trade cycle, but also to its thirst for demon rum. Stigma of slavery was on sugar everywhere, but most particularly in Britain. Everywhere, sugar had become a source of public wealth and national importance. Through taxes and tariffs on sugar, the government had maintained a partner in organized crime. Fabulous fortunes were being amassed by plantation owners, planters, traders, and shippers. And the sole concern of European royalty was how they can get their take and their cut. It took only three centuries for the European consciousness to be raised to the point where the first saccharum was the first word for sugar, came from Latin. Raised to the point where the first anti-saccharite society was formed in 1792. Anti-sugar society. Okay, the British sugar boycott soon spread throughout Europe. The British East India companies already had their ears up, right? That's when they start this big thing, well, our sugar wasn't produced by slaves and all this other stuff. So, very interesting. All right, jumping ahead. However, by the time sugar was introduced widely in Europe, the natural healers were uncovered. Now, we're going to see here about what we today know as witches and how they got the bad rap that they did. However, by the time the sugar was introduced widely in Europe, the natural healers were uncovered practically overnight as a declared enemy of church and state. Ailing people consulted them at very real peril. One literally risked life and limb having any truck with them. In turn, they risk life and limb to aid you. The church declared in the 14th century that if a woman dared to cure without having studied, she is a witch and must die. See, at this time, before the Christianization of Europe, there were natural healers in the various tribes and clans and peoples of Europe. There were women, even some men, but mostly women who studied nature. They knew how to concoct herbs to heal things and this and that. And they were very in tune with what you put in your mouth is conducive to your level of health. Garbage in, garbage out. All right. Catholics and Protestant churchmen forbade the exercising of healing arts or the dispensing of common sense wisdom under pain of death. Never mind that such people had spent their entire lives in practical study. They had studied the order of the universe, the seeds and the stars, the animals, the birds, the bees, and their native habitat. Nature and tradition was their teachers, not the scriptures as interpreted by the priest. The printing press did not exist. All knowledge and history, not in the hands of all-powerful priests, was passed on from natural healer to natural healer. If you sought out a sorceress complaining of an upset stomach, she would question you on what you've been eating, give you sound advice, and perhaps a herbal infusion to settle your stomach. If you went to a natural healer complaining of melancholy, migraine, or madness, she would also know it must have been something you ate. Sugar, perhaps. So you were given stern advice and perhaps a potion for infusion to settle your brain. Suddenly, those days were gone. Natural healing had become witchcraft. If your hallucinations were attributed to sugar, and word of it got around, the whole encounter could be turned on its head. You had been bewitched. The sorceress was spreading evil tidings against sugar to harm the new national enterprise, blessed by the church and profitable to the state. Bewitchment was the province of the exorcist and the priest. The cure prescribed was for the bewitched person to denounce the natural healer as a witch or a wizard, the source of the unholy spell. The punishment? Burning at the stake. Inquisitors complained bitterly that bewitched persons consulted the sources and were cured of by natural means. The common method of taking off bewitchment, they wrote, is for the bewitched person to resort to wise women by whom they were very frequently cured, and not by the priest or exorcist. Such cures were effected by the help of devils, and it is unlawful to seek. Therefore, it cannot be lawful thus to cure bewitchment. It must be patiently borne. So, in other words, you need to suffer through it, because if you get any natural cures or anything like that from herbs and stuff like that, well, that means you're a devil. You know, it's interesting to read how the Christian church really screwed up a lot of Europe, you know. It was behind a lot of the wars that we fought. White men killing white men. I've been wondering how things would have turned out if we weren't Christianized. Something tells me we might be in a better lot under the sun. All right, going on. In the age of witch hunts, the disorders, occurrences, and signs were divided into two categories. Those thought to be your own fault, physical, and those thought to be the work of the devil, mental. The milk sick, stomach ache, galloping consumption, and other obvious signs and warnings were clearly physical. Invisible symptoms, however, from melancholy to a migraine headache to madness, were bewitchment. With the support of kings and princes, the medieval church asserted complete control over medical education and practice. The infamous 1486 manual for witch hunters, the Malleus Maleficarum, the Hammer of the Witches, defined witches as those who try to induce others to perform evil wonders. Healing was one of the wonders that they had in mind. Heresy was sweepingly defined as infidelity in a person who had been baptized. Midwives were singled out as surpassing all others in wickedness. Wow, interesting. They may never have been male chauvinist pigs to surpass the inquisitors who declared that all witchcraft comes from carnal lust, which is in women insatiable. When male physicians were barred from attending births, a curious German physician in drag as a midwife crashed a delivery. He was found out and burned at the stake. Now the pendulum has swung all the way. And sudden drastic onset of illness, or what looked like illness, pointed to witchcraft. To diagnose witchcraft, inquisitors relied on physicians to diagnose or to distinguish between those disorders due to natural causes and those stemming from witchcraft. Yet another way of distinguishing between natural, meaning physical, disorders and supernatural, meaning mental disorders, was the medieval Rorschach test. You know, like when you go to the doctor and they hold up an ink blot and they ask you what it looks like. Molten lead was poured over the patient's body and then poured into the water. If the lead formed a recognizable image, punishment was swift. Whatever the shape of the lead, the inquisitors could always find a reason that proved indubitably that the patient was suffering from exactly the problem originally diagnosed. Look at the harm that these people did. I mean, it really... I mean, you think about all the people, all the white people that were killed, not even in wars, but were killed because they were accused of being a witch. When Roman Emperor Constantine embraced Christianity and began coercing his subjects to join the official Roman state church, it was the people in the rural areas who resisted. City priests scornfully denounced the pagans or country people. The inquisitors never ventured down the dark pagan roads to knock on any doors because they were outnumbered in such areas. The natural healers were defended and protected as keepers of the flame. Their wisdom and traditions were preserved intact underground. Witches were not for burning. Look at all that. I mean, can you imagine all the knowledge that we lost because of the church? Now, we have the story of Beowulf that survives today, but it was written down, well, the written copy we have is by an Anglo-Saxon monk who Christianized it. You know the original story wasn't Christian at all, because Christians didn't believe in dragons, and Beowulf's going around killing dragons. So think of all the literature that we've lost because the church has probably burned it. And not only that, but the natural healing arts, all of it lost because of Jewish mysticism. Much of that deep historical antagonism is buried in language and symbols. Christians called natural healers sorcerers, from the Latin word, which means someone who drew lots, or tarot cards, or yarrow sticks, to foretell the future. Christians began to call all unbelievers pagans. Pagans called their natural healer the good woman. The natural healer dealt with herbs and potions. These were mysteries to the priest, who felt it necessary to maintain the total monopoly on all mysteries. Centuries of horror are buried in the saga of the transformation of the natural healer into the Halloween witch. And that's what they've done. Right here it says, this is a quote from the modern psychiatrist. Well, modern. This book was written in 1975, by the way. Modern psychiatrist, Dr. Thomas S. Zsasz. His last name is spelled S-Z-A-S-Z. I believe S-Z in Polish makes a zh sound, so I guess it's pronounced Zsasz. Was scathingly summarized the price of hypocrisy in his book called The Manufacture of Madness. Since the modern physician, and especially the psychiatrist, systematically repudiates his real medieval ancestor, the lowly and disreputable sorcerer and witch. Instead, he prefers to trace his descent directly to the Hippocratic physicians of ancient Greece, skipping over the embarrassment of the Middle Ages in silence. Middle Ages, when they burned all the natural healers, accusing them of being witches. The medical science has paid the heavy price that such a bargain with falsehood invariably entails by denying his origins instead of identifying with those who have aggressed against their predecessors. The modern physician forfeits his identity as a modest but independent healer, skeptical of the dogma of established social authority, and becomes instead a servile vassal of the state. In the official histories of the contemporary medicine, the denial of the sorceress and witch as healer forms an important link in this faithful transformation of the physician's role from individual entrepreneur to bureaucratic employee. Very interesting. You know, incidentally, there was a Japanese guy in the 1960s who said, you know, the only thing that America has to do to beat the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese is instead of dropping bombs, drop American PXs. You know, PX is where you can buy your candy and your cakes and your donuts and stuff like that. Also, you can buy toiletries there, too. You know, toothpaste, toothbrush. So all I got to do is drop PXs, commissaries, behind enemy lines, and that'll take care of it. It's amazing. Now, this author who wrote this, he gives pretty detailed information about what he went through, how when he got off of sugar, willingly got off of sugar and traced all his health problems to the consumption of sugar. And his withdrawal was very painful. I mean, he just felt like shit, you know. And he says it happens. One day he just woke up and he was ready to go. He just woke up like someone just gave him a shot of vitamin B12 or something. And he said that he lost all this weight. In fact, on the back of the book, he has one picture of him before, which is a fat, pudgy face, and after is a slim, lean-looking face, you know. I think all of us out there want to become like Cassius. We want to be lean and hungry men. You know, Caesar said, beware of Cassius. He's a lean and hungry man. I want men around me who are fat and happy, who don't think too much, basically. All right. In more than 20 years of psychiatric work, writes Dr. Thomas Jaj, I have never known a clinical psychiatrist to report on the basis of a projective test that the subject is a normal, mentally healthy person. While some witches may have survived dunking, no madman survives psychological testing. And there's no behavior or person that the modern psychiatrist cannot plausibly diagnose as abnormal or ill. So it was in the 17th century. Once the doctor or the exorcist had been called in, he was under pressure to do something. When he tried and failed, the poor patient had to be put away. And it is often said that the surgeons buried their mistakes. Physicians and psychiatrists put them away, locked them up. The excesses of the inquisitors and witch hunters eventually produced a predictable backlash, a wave of revulsion and horror. Physicians and priests who had starred in these dramas were now in an uneasy partnership that reminded everyone of the blood on their hands. Yesterday's heresy became institutionalized as the multiple new Protestant orthodoxies. People left the church in droves, and the royal partners had to rush into the breach and impose heavy fines on the dropouts for missing church on Sunday. Things went from bad to worse. The orgies of witch burning and exorcism had failed to stem the tide of bewitchment and possession and madness, which later on in the book he traces all to sugar consumption. You know what it is? Sugar does, it wears out the body, from what I've read. You know, this ground up glass going through your system, just tearing you up, wears out your adrenal glands, your endocrine system, wears out your kidneys, your liver, just wears it out. Because these glands and these organs have to produce all these chemicals to either break down the sugar and carry it into the blood, and then, but the most sensitive organ to sugar is the brain. Okay. Stem the tide of bewitchment, possession, and madness. Now physicians and clergymen were under pressure to come up with a new explanation for the symptoms and signs of the sugar blues that boggled men's minds and disturbed their emotions. In 1710, an anonymous clergyman physician came up with the answer. Had they been given out Nobel Prize in those days, he surely would have rated one. His simple, surefire explanation for madness would satisfy physicians and priests for three centuries. It would keep them happy, busy, and rich. Although children have been doing it since the dawn of time, neither the Greeks, Romans, Egyptians, Orientals, or Persians had a proper word for it. The anonymous clergyman, physician, raided his Bible and perverted the legend of Onan into a new sin called Onanism. He wrote a book, Onania, or the heinous sin of self-pollution. The physicians raided their Latin dictionaries and corrupted the closest Latin word, manustrupration, to defile by hand. This was smoothed into the word masturbation, which finally made the Oxford English Dictionary in 1766. Onania was a bestseller. The scientists, who knew a good thing when they saw it, got into the act, dropping some of the hellfire religious crudities in favor of pseudoscientific buttressing. Besides, who could say that masturbation didn't produce insanity? For a successful case against the theory, you would have to admit having masturbated for years, then prove your sanity. No one dared try it. See that? See the bullshit that we've been enslaved by? I don't know about you, but this makes me a little bit mad. All right, the great French psychiatrist Esquirol, Esquirol, I don't know how to pronounce that, joined the chorus, declaring that masturbation is recognized in all countries as a common cause of insanity. Unless it is stopped at once, it is an insurmountable obstacle to cure, reduce a patient to a state of stupidity, tuberculosis. Tuberculosis blamed on masturbation. Okay. Marasmus, gradually wasting of tissue, and death may be a forerunner of mania. Dementia leads to melancholy and suicide. The notion that masturbation caused insanity was accepted by the civilized world. Amazing. Masturbation supplied a perfect safety valve for medical brains. We can cure you unless you masturbate and keep on masturbating, they declared. Therefore, if you were incurable, you were put in an asylum, which had a sure cure for masturbation, the straitjacket. And those on probation wore chastity belts by day and spiked rings for sleeping. I don't know what the spiked rings are. I never heard of that. It was only a matter of time before the surgeons, it was only a matter of time until the surgeons joined in. Their contribution, the Old Testament ritual of circumcision. Originally, an operation for the removal of the female clitoris was devised. In the 1850s, Dr. Isaac Baker Brown, I'll bet that was a fucking Jew. Isaac Brown. Jews have a lot of colors for last names. I'll bet that was a Jew. Prominent London surgeon, later president of the Medical Society of London, created a surgical procedure called the clitoridectomy on the ground that masturbation was a form of moral leprosy which caused hysteria, epilepsy, and convulsive diseases. The first medical union in this country, years before the AMA, was the Association of Medical Superintendents of American Institutions for the Insane. It was founded in 1844 at a time when general stores on the American frontier were giving away a half pound of sugar free to any youngster who came into the store to make a purchase of a nickel or more. This pronouncement of the first union of hedge shrinkers in the sweet land of liberty was a resolution in defense of the straitjacket. Resolve that it is to the unanimous sense of this convention that the attempt to abandon entirely the use of all means of personal restraint is not sanctioned by the true interests of the insane. In 1855, an editorial in the New Orleans Medical and Surgical Journal declare that neither the plague, nor war, nor smallpox, nor a crowd of similar evils have resulted more disastrously for humanity than the habit of masturbation. It is the destroying element of civilized society. Well, you know, they didn't want to go after the source of all the problems, because sugar was a moneymaker. I don't know if I have time to read all this here. In 1897, Freud wrote, "It has dawned on me that masturbation is one major habit, the primal addiction, and it is only a substitute and a replacement for it that the other addictions of alcohol, morphine, and tobacco, etc., come into existence." He didn't mention cocaine or sugar because he was hooked on both of them himself. Centuries of comic book horror practiced by the medical and psychiatric fraternity in the treatment of madness caused by masturbation are strangely missing from our medical history books. Among millions of words devoted to self-glorification, not one is devoted to masturbatory insanity, according to Dr. Zhaje. Like the involvement of the physician in the horror of the witch hunt, this sorry story is sunk without a trace. Dr. Zhaje compares most aptly to the Constitution of the United States when it mentions no subject of Negroes, whatever. In the same way, official psychiatry remains among the most retarded sectors of the medical fraternity in recognizing that the inability of human systems to handle sugar is reflected in the whole range of symptoms of what they insist on calling mental illness. It was as late as 1911 that Eugene Bleuler coined the fearsome word schizophrenia, which supplanted the dementia, and dementia praecox, whatever it's called. The latter merely means precocious madness. The symptom appeared among the young. The only thing new was the name. The symptoms were as old as sugar. In earlier times, physicians, bewildered by the same symptoms, had pronounced their patients bewitched. Now they were pronounced schizophrenic. Where once such people had been turned over to the exorcists, now they were abandoned to the psychiatrists. Masturbation did not drive anyone mad anymore. What did? The efforts of mama trying to stop masturbation. Or insanity could have been caused by toilet training that was too much too soon. Breakfast quarrels with papa. Inconsistent discipline, lack of love, or too much of it. Anything in the family history that could be recalled, poverty, riches, stress, or ease. When psychiatry proved no better than exorcism, some shrinks turned to a more drastic methods like shock therapy of all kinds, from drugs to electricity to insulin. In 1935, Egas Moniz of Lisbon, Portugal, I guess, introduced the ultimate answer to schizophrenia, the prefrontal lobotomy. Surgical incision into the brain. 1949, Moniz was awarded the Nobel Prize for having pioneered the ultimate horror. Well, it goes on, compared to this Moniz guy who did the frontal lobotomy. There was a guy in the 1940s named John Tintera who discovered that the chief complaints of his patients were often similar to those he found in persons whose systems were unable to handle sugar, fatigue, nervousness, depression, apprehension, craving for sweets, inability to handle alcohol, inability to concentrate, allergies, low blood sugar, the sugar blues. He finally insisted that his patients submit to a 4-hour glucose tolerance test. Well, make a long story short, this guy was... this guy was hounded his whole time in the medical profession. You know, perhaps Tintera's untimely death in 1969 at the age of 57 made it easy for the medical profession to accept discoveries that at once seemed as far out as a simple Oriental medical thesis of genetics and diet, yin and yang. Say, doctors all over the world are repeating what Tintera announced years ago. Nobody, but nobody should ever be allowed to begin what is called psychiatric treatment any place, anywhere, unless and until they have had a glucose tolerance test to discover if they can handle sugar. This stuff is poison. Now, this show was basically on the history, a concise history of sugar in the Western world. And look what it's done. I mean, you know, I heard a Danish tourist come over to America, and one of the things they take pictures of to show off back home are pictures of fat Americans. We have the fattest people on the planet. Because there's way too much sugar in our society. Now, I've just recently kicked the sugar habit. Believe me, I went through some withdrawals. I went through the withdrawals because of my staying away from the Monster energy drinks. Even having one every day, when you stop having them, man, you feel like shit for at least a day. Headaches, you have no energy. If your body goes through that, then that means it's not good for you. But other people out there need to kick the sugar habit. And you know who you are. You just need to do it. You'll become a better Aryan warrior for it. So we must secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. Carpe noctem. Seize the night. Starve the sheep inside you and feed the wolf. And make shield wall and wolf heart part of your mental makeup. Kick the sugar habit. You will be better for it. You will be better for your race for it. You'll be in better health, better energy, better mental acuteness. Okay? Sugar is dragging us down. It has made us passive. It's made us content, fat, and happy. And we will not be content, fat, and happy any longer. In order for us to manifest Rahoa, we need to change some of the things that go in our mouth. Alcohol, sugar, whatever. You know what you need to do. Do it now. You don't want to do it when the lights go out. It'll be harder then. 14.
Well, you know, I've been pushing that story for a long time and recommending Sugar Blues, one of the best books I ever read about the addiction of sugar. Now, do you notice how in every drugstore, you know, CVS just decided not long ago to not sell cigarettes, but they'd be far better selling cigarettes than all the candy they sell. The whole front of the store is candy. At least two or three aisles of candy, candy, candy. You go into places like you wouldn't think you'd even have much candy in, like we have a big R here in town, which is for farming and gardening and seed and farm equipment. The whole front of the store is candy. I knew the manager. I complained to him, and of course, you know, it doesn't do any good. He said, well, that's the corporate. They make that decision. Everything now, anything you complain about at a store, they always give you, that's corporate. Whether it's the music at a restaurant is crazy, and you say, let's get some reasonable music in here. Anything you complain about, they just say, well, it's the corporate. They just palm it off, you know. And then you call corporate, and, you know, nothing ever happens. But people be far better smoking cigarettes than devouring all this candy and sugar. Now, really, it's sort of the joke's on us, too, in this way, that the sugar plantations are obviously taken care of by blacks. Not only in the United States, but all over the place, all over the world, because it started, I guess, over in the Middle East. But you see, they can cut off a piece of sugar cane and suck on it all day long. It's not going to hurt them. But processed and granulated sugar is what gets you. So here, and of course, sugar used to be quite expensive. Only the rich could afford it. So the rich are chowing down with this sugar, and the nigger slave, he couldn't. So his health was a lot better. But if you chop off a piece of cane in a sugar field, you can suck on it, and it's very good, and it's natural. Now, I saw what this could do many years ago when a Klansman in Los Angeles went to jail, and he had two kids, and his wife was trying to get him out and all that kind of stuff. Well, we took their two boys. They were about 5 or 6 and maybe 8 to our house in Fallbrook, and they were bouncing off the wall. These kids were out of control, unbelievable. And we took them off sugar. No sugar whatsoever, no way, any way we could cut it down. And within 2 or 3 weeks, those kids were fine. You know, I see kids like that in the stores with their parents all, you know, going crazy and jumping up and down, out of control. They just need to cut out that sugar, soft drinks, all that stuff. But most of them won't do it. I've been asked by a lone wolf and his she-wolf to put some more of these Sling Blade shows on. And I was going to put one on during the week this week, and somehow it got away from me. Well, I'll put on at least 2 a week until we run out. Maybe he'll come back on the appear again. Maybe he'll come out of hiding and make some more shows. So anyhow, that's it for today, and we'll be back on Moon's Day. And, oh, yeah, have you noticed all the niggers on the ads, all these Christmas ads? I mean, it's just absolutely overwhelming with niggers and white girls and hugging and kissing and everything else. I just saw one of these top young country boys on a country music channel. And, hell, he's down there with a Mexican. It's one of those video things. He was with a Mexican laying her out. And so... it's everywhere. It's absolutely overwhelming. I've never seen so many niggers in advertising and everything else in my life. It is really sickening. Well, hopefully there's going to be payback. I think sometimes that things go way too far one way, then all of a sudden, bammo, they come back the other way. Let's hope for it. And I put a sign out front. Also to did you give reverence to your mom and dad, or did you give reverence to spooks in the sky? We'll see whether that'll get me a bottle, empty bottle through my window. 14-5 and kick their ass, and don't be afraid to say nigger. Don't be afraid to say spick. It's almost the only defense you've got anymore. Yeah. And keep your mouth shut.
See him arrive. He stood 6'6" and weighed 245, kind of broad at the shoulder and narrow at the hip. And everybody knew you didn't give no lip to Big John.
Big John. Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
Nobody seemed to know where John called home. He just drifted into town and stayed all alone. He didn't say much, he was kind of quiet and shy. And if you spoke at all, you just said hi to Big John. Somebody said he came from New Orleans, where he got in a fight over a Cajun queen, and a crashing blow from a huge right hand sent a Louisiana fella to the promised land, Big John.
Big John. Big John.
Big Bad John.
pigeon.
Then came the day at the bottom of the mine when a timber cracked and men started crying. Miners were praying and hearts beat fast, and everybody thought that they'd breathed their last, except John. Through the dust and the smoke of this man-made hell walked a giant of a man that the miners knew well, grabbed a sagging timber and gave out with a groan, and like a giant oak tree just stood there alone, Big John.
Big John. Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
And with all of his strength, he gave a mighty shove. Then a miner yelled out, "There's a light up above." And 20 men scrambled from a would-be grave. And now there's only one left down there to save Big John. With jacks and timbers, they started back down. Then came that rumble way down in the ground. And the smoke and gas belched out of that mine. Everybody knew it was the end of the line for Big John.
Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.
Now they never reopened that worthless pit. They just placed a marble stand in front of it. These few words are written on that stand. At the bottom of this mine lies a big, big man. Big John.
Big John. Big John.
Big Bad John.
Big John.